listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Thousands of demonstrators opposed to the Vietnam War assembled in the nation's capital for a mass protest. A three-hour parade takes the demonstrators across the Potomac on their way to the Pentagon.
The date was October 21st, 1967, 50 years ago last month.
It is at the Pentagon where the first test of strength comes.
The official estimate of the crowd size was 50,000.
Military police contain the crowd, but clashes soon break out. Federal marshals arrest several who attempt to break through the protective line.
Among those arrested, two men. One, a famous author, the other, a veteran. We spoke with the latter, Walter Teague, who since that day 50 years ago has been a tireless advocate for peace. We spoke with him via Skype from Maryland Monday.
My name is Walter Darwin Teague III. That's important because...
I was going to ask you, were you related to the guy that they call the father of modern industrial design? So you are.
Yes.
Right.
That was my grandfather.
Gotcha.
So my mother ended up divorcing my dad very quickly. And so she and I and other kids became like the black sheep of the family. So... my grandfather, you know, is famous for being one of the primary industrial designers in the world. Yeah. Did a lot of famous stuff. And my father was an engineer, and I had very little contact with him. And so, you know, later on, I didn't have the standard upbringing or education that, you know, sons, scions of the wealthy usually are expected to have.
Right.
We didn't have any money. So I ended up going to the Air Force because I didn't have an education and thought I might learn something. And I did. I learned about the U.S. Empire. I was stationed on Okinawa. And my political education actually began somewhat before that, when we lived in Virginia during segregation, during the Second World War and before. And I was horrified by what I saw. And I was horrified also that all the adults, teachers, family, whatever, when I asked them, what the hell is going on? What is this about? They basically didn't want to talk about it. So Okinawa opened my eyes up about the international stuff, and it came back to the civil rights movement, and that led to the beginnings of the Vietnam War, U.S. war against Vietnam. And I became somewhat notorious because I chose to take on a particular task, and this defined what I did then until the present. I felt that it'd be a hell of a lot better if we figure out how to prevent wars rather than always reacting. And the anti-war movement in 64, 65 was basically came out of the pacifist movement, the old left, some of them, and the sort of a moral tone. You know, the war was morally bad. I felt that that wasn't going to work with ordinary Americans very well, because they were being told that the Vietnamese, Viet Cong, as they called them then, you know, were going to stab our boys in the back, the usual, right, you know, propaganda. And it worked. People were scared, worried. And for that reason, they would then, you know, support the war, send their sons off or whatever. So I felt the peace movement had to include an educational aspect about why the Vietnamese were fighting. And so in 64, I got this idea. In 65, we started a group. We put, the name was meant to be controversial. It was called the U.S. Committee to Aid the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam. Yikes. Well, at that time, everyone would say, what?
Yeah, it sounds like per se treason right at the time.
It sounds like what?
Per se treason. In other words, you're advocating, you know, support for the enemy, quote unquote. Right. That's the way they would deal with it in a courtroom.
Right. But I knew that that was the danger. And in fact, my Freedom of Information files showed that the government tried to get me for sedition, the old 1914-17 laws, equivalent to treason. They couldn't do it because nobody would testify against me. They got all these agents, you know, they pay them. And they said, oh, we heard him say this and say that, which I didn't say, because I was smart enough to know not to advocate treason, you know. And I was a veteran. That helped a little bit. And, you know, so I presented this as an ethical question, historical question. And I said, look, we fought against the British Empire for our liberation, our independence. Should we not understand why the Vietnamese might want to fight for their independence?
Right.
Whether it's against the French Empire, the Japanese Empire, or now the American acting like an empire.
Now, this is what Ho Chi Minh had actually been saying for a very long time, that, you know, he was like the George Washington, and he would cite American history when he would talk about
the situation. Exactly. Their Declaration of Independence quotes from our Declaration of Independence.
That's right. That's right.
So, you know, they were smart people, and they wanted to stay alive. They did not want a war. But faced with what they saw as aggression, invasion, whatever, they chose to fight for their, you know, independence. And my argument was, if the anti-war movement doesn't discuss this, it's almost like saying, well, yeah, they are our enemy, and we won't win that war with average Americans. I mean, that political argument with average Americans, because they'll say, well, yeah, but, and so we figured, well, look, let's see if we can stimulate or push the anti-war movement to start discussing these issues. And so we formed this group, Committee to Aid the National Liberation Front, and people would say, what's the National Liberation Front? And we say, ah, that's what the Americans military calls the Viet Cong. So we began a dialogue, and lots of people did. We weren't the only one, but a lot of people did. And within the next 3 or 4 years, there were the teach-ins and, you know, all the big demonstrations leading up to the one where you and I met, the issue of the Pentagon, the demonstration at the Pentagon or against the Pentagon. And, you know, by 1971, things had changed a lot. It was no longer necessary to bring up the history as much, because people now by then knew a lot about it or more about it. And now the war was about how to get out and how to, you know, what would happen next. So I see that I became, after that, I became a social worker, psychotherapist, and did a lot of other stuff in, you know, relating to the wars that continued. We still haven't learned how to how to stop the wars that, you know, the U.S. is bent on waging. So yeah, that's my history.
That's interesting. At the time, you formulate this presentation. In other words, you start to put together a lesson plan, basically, for the American public. And, you know, talk about 64, 65. We just missed, and there was a pretty, you know, wide understanding of the fact that we had just missed having a nuclear war with Russia, you know, 15, 16 months earlier, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 1962. I remember knowing about it as someone in fourth grade, because we were drilling for nuclear war by hiding in the hallways. So you have an understanding on the one hand of what war would actually mean, and you would think with that, with some of the other things that had been happening with the fight against colonialism, that you know, the Kennedy administration, at least rhetorically, even as it fought that, had kind of embraced, and some of the media had started to embrace here, you would think that there would have been a very receptive audience to the message that you were bringing in that climate. But in fact, that's not what I remember also, that the American people were pretty well tuned up by the media and, you know, the culture generally for this war.
Right. Right. And I mean, my concern, as you know, coming, I wasn't raised to be politically aware. I had to learn that on my own. Mm. What I saw on Okinawa, which is still occupied to this day, primarily by the U.S. military. What I saw was that the government was saying one thing. They called that the garden spot of the Pacific, and that we were in Okinawa to bring democracy and so forth, which was not true if you opened your eyes and you lived there. So when I came back and saw the civil rights movement, I put these things together. And what I realized was the answer to the question of how and why couldn't people realize the danger that these kinds of wars and nuclear, you know, confrontations pose. I think this is my theory, when I formed pretty early on, which was that the history of racism and conquest, which we were taught in school, you know, in the 40s, the 50s, you know, the wars of expansion against the Native Americans, they were a wonderful thing. We had we spread the country westward, and the only good Indian when I was a kid was a dead Indian.
We played cowboys and Indians when we were kids with guns and caps that and stuff.
So, I mean, not everybody, but you know, the kids, and we were the majority back then. And so, you know, there was no questioning of any of these things. The questioning began, and from my observation, began among the people who are most oppressed: Native Americans, Blacks, Hispanics, and so forth. And you know, and if you were poor, you had to sort of pick sides a little bit. Well, I got involved with the Vietnam War because I was horrified. I saw what was coming. I mean, I didn't know all the details, but I could see that they were going to bomb, you know, tremendous amount of bomb. It was in the cards. One of the first activities that my group did was to try and have a big demonstration to prevent the bombing of the port city of Haiphong. Haiphong is the main port in the northern part of Vietnam.
Right.
And it's where they were getting food supplies and other supplies. And the U.S. was planning to bomb that area to prevent that. And so we tried to hold a demonstration in New York City with all the old traditional left groups and some of the newer ones. And it was an educational lesson for us, because the concept of having a demonstration before something happens, that was hard for people to understand. They started arguing politics and arguing, you know, we couldn't do this, we couldn't do that, and so forth. So throughout those first 4 or 5 years, until by 1971, and especially around the Pentagon demonstration, our group was mainly trying to push the anti-war movement to take a stronger stand, but we were not the only one. There was, the main thing that was happening around that time was students, youth, SDS, for example, a lot of minority groups were becoming more active, you know, which led to Panthers and many others. And the old leadership, which had the money and the basic control of the big demonstrations, they didn't know what to do with these young whippersnappers who were, you know, wanting a more militant confrontation. Now, the fact is, in 1967, when the Pentagon demonstration took place, the so-called radicals were not trying to create a violent situation. They were saying to the leadership, we should have a political confrontation. We should name what the Pentagon is about. We should confront them and force the issue into the media and so forth. Now, that was about as radical as they got. Right. So, you know, I became somewhat famous because Norman Mailer wrote a book called Armies of the Night,
right,
which was maybe not a bestseller, but it was got all kinds of awards and
Pulitzer
so forth.
Prize for general nonfiction, for example, and a National Book Award in Arts and Letters. Yeah,
right. And what the essence? I'm writing a piece on it, which I hope to get finished. I'm in the middle of it. Should have written it 50 years ago, but I was busy. But I'm writing a piece to try to explain why did Mailer depict the anti-war movement the way he did. And my thesis is that, you know, he saw the anti-war movement, you know, he was supportive of the movement in the sense he thought the war was wrong, but he thought it was wrong for reasons that were sort of liberal politics. In other words, not anything to do with history of Vietnam or radical understanding of economics, politics, and so on.
Tactical as opposed to strategic, basically.
Right. And so his book, if you read it, it's a long description of how wonderful Norman Mailer is at a demonstration.
Like much of what he's written over the years, right?
Right. And what was interesting was I didn't know this guy. I didn't have time to read his stuff. But we met. We were arrested almost at the same point. Mm-hmm. And so I spent time in prison with him. And his secretary, after we got out, called us and asked for a detailed scenario of what happened. So we sent him a very moment-by-moment history of the entire demonstration that we were involved in. And so I know he had the details. I know he had the facts. The book turns a lot of that around. And what does he do? Well, he praises Mailer, but the way he praises Mailer and Mailer's politics, which are sort of, you know, against the war, but don't do anything radical to change the system.
Right.
System's okay, but the war's not. So what he did was he needed a battle. He needed a contestant to be so he could be the champion. And what he did was he used me, pumped me up, my role up, exaggerated it. And in the book, he writes that he's ultimately defeated me in these big debates in the prison. There were about 400 of us at one time in Akawan prison. I think 700 were arrested. And there were debates, but Mailer was irrelevant. So he writes in the book how he won the debate, but he was irrelevant to the debate. He was basically walking around in his undershorts, pumping his chest out, telling everybody about his great arrest. Well, the people that didn't give a damn, you know, who's this guy, creepy guy, you know?
He called himself the Nijinsky of ambivalence or something, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's all about him and it's all weird. And it's irrelevant. And so, but what I want to point out, people ask me, what were the lies in the book? The basic lie is that Mailer was the primary champion and definer of what this demonstration was about. And he should be the one who should be listened to and believed about where things are going. Well, he was wrong. The demonstrations after 67 got more radical.
Right.
You know, many different groups joined. They got bigger. It was no longer something controlled by a bunch of well-funded old, you know, good people, but not representing the youth or where things were going in the world. And so in the book, he pumps me up, says a bunch of things that didn't actually happen or distorts what happened. And there was a debate, but the debate was one that was reflected the entire anti-war movement at that time. The young people, the people arrested in this prison, they were criticizing the leadership for having been too mild, too slow, too a lot of things. And I got involved not because I was leading it at all, but because they thought I could get a petition to the National Guardian, which was the main progressive newspaper at that time. And I said, well, if you make a petition and you get people to sign it, I'll take it. But I suggest that you not only criticize the leadership, but you suggest how what they should have done.
Right.
You know, make you know, right. more. Anyway, so they were working on that. And then Mailer and I got bailed out at the same time. Some of my committee members were helping to make sure that the pacifists didn't only bail pacifists, because that was happening. So they bailed me and Mailer out same time. And so the young people gave me the petition to take with me. So in the book, Mailer writes that only half the people signed the petition because of his wonderful arguments. Well, it's not true at all. Only half signed because that's when I was told to leave.
Right.
little pieces of history.
Well, you know, he's a novelist, so and it's a fictional piece, really. We don't generally acknowledge journalism in the U.S. as being fictional, although most of it is. But in this case, it's actually listed more or less as fiction, and so
he calls it the history as a novel or novel.
So, but it's a form that essentially requires some of these devices just to move the ball forward. But he did, as anyone who read anything about or by Mailer or both knows, put himself at the center of most of the ink that came out of his pen. And that's there for sure in this book.
Yeah, it's true, and you're right, and it's a technique that works. Though remember, his that book and his point of view was the dominant point of view in the media, right, if the media was against the war, for quite some time.
Right.
And so he set the tone. In that sense, the book was successful to make the radicals and progressives look strange, weird, or wrong.
Right.
And, most of the anti-war movement didn't pay too much attention to Mailer after that.
Right.
Went on and did what they needed to do to organize locally. Biggest example would be the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, groups like that, which were much more relevant and authentic.
Right.
But one small thing I want to mention: the conflict was an example of how the conflict was occurring. The organizers of that big demonstration, it was at least 100,000 at the Lincoln Memorial, they wanted to have speakers and no march to the Pentagon. They were scared.
Yeah.
The young people wanted to go to the Pentagon and did, at least 50,000.
Right.
But before they did, one of the speakers that I helped organize was the first Vietnamese to ever speak at a major anti-war demonstration in the U.S., a wonderful man who was like the head of the anti-war Vietnamese in the United States. Nguyen Van Lui was his name. And the organizers were afraid to have him speak until they checked him out and made sure he wasn't going to say bad things, demanded a copy of his speech ahead of time, which I got them. And then they said, okay, you have like 2 or 3 minutes and so forth. They gave him the mic in the middle of his speech, like a minute and a half in, they cut him off, turned off the mic.
Wow.
And that was, they were scared. It was stupid and insulting. He was very diplomatic about it.
Mm-hmm.
A great man. He was the equivalent of Ho Chi Minh in the sense of dedication, his personal life and his story and so forth.
Right.
Had gotten medals from the American OSS and things like that for his work during the Second World War and so forth. So all of this stuff I've posted on my website, which is redandgreen.org, spelled out redandgreen.org. And I mentioned that because history, and I am positive these days to see young people getting information. They don't read as much books and things, but they get information from the web. They are obviously learning to be critical and not buy into everything that they see, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really important that history be reexamined in all these areas, American history. I mean, for example, when I meet Vietnamese, and I occasionally meet Vietnamese who come in to the embassy and so forth, have functions and so on. Young ones who don't know their own history, I'll say to you, I'll ask them, when was the first American aggression against Vietnam? And they don't know. They think, you know, maybe 1954 or something like that. 1845. The U.S. Constitution, the ship we all know about, right? Old Ironsides?
Yeah, yeah.
Learned about that ship in school?
For sure.
Yeah. That ship was captained by a guy named John Percival, and they called him Mad Jack. Mad Jack John Percival. And he took the ship to Vietnam, among other places, and attacked, ended up killing a whole bunch of Vietnamese, sinking some ships, tried to create a war, basically. And, you know, eventually he had to sail away. But that was the first U.S. aggression against Vietnam, 1845.
Yep.
And
yeah, Percival was some character. He, you know, he decides to do a world tour, in essence, and refits the USS Constitution to do the tour. And Vietnam, that was one of the places that had the benefit of his, you know, his attention during that time.
Right. Well, since I don't know why they did it, but recently, the Prager, I think it's Prager Books, which is I think has some CIA connections, published a full book about him, basically trying to rewrite history and say how wonderful he is, you know, or was. And it's full of distortions and so forth. Now, this is not unlike the fact that while we're talking, the Pentagon has a new effort to rewrite the history of Vietnam, the 50th anniversary memorials that they're set up around the country, 13 years of organizing to basically say that the U.S. was right in Vietnam and should have won and would have won, et cetera, et cetera.
Except for the Russians.
And this is going on all around the United States. Yep. I mean, it's not a small thing.
Right.
Let me
ask you about that.
Yeah.
And we're getting tight on time. We got about 5 minutes left. But and I want to go to this too, because you know, we had protests that, you know, in advance of a war in Iraq, for example. I remember in February 15th. In fact, I just saw this go by on Facebook. One of my friends, you know, a 250,000 people came out just in New York City. It was freezing. It was one of those like 20 degree wind chill, snow on the ground days. Spontaneously came millions of people around the world, perhaps the largest, at least at that time, demonstration in the history of humanity against that war. And within a month, the U.S. was bombing the hell out of Iraq anyway, completely disregarding it. What role can and should people, you know, I mean, we're looking at maybe a massive, like a real war with Russia and or China. What role should we be playing with the lessons that we've learned from what happened in Vietnam?
Oh, well, I think we have a huge challenge because, you know, in the last few months, Ken Burns' documentary on the Vietnam War was put out on PBS. And it's going to be used in classrooms and colleges all around. And it's basically a massive, well-done propaganda documentary.
Right.
But for most people who will see it, they don't know the history. They're right. Not like us who know some of what really happened.
Right.
So they'll absorb that stuff. Now, if you've got the Pentagon making excuses for Vietnam, you've got Ken Burns saying, you know, this is the way it happened. This is how to understand it. It's very difficult to get people to appreciate how we've been lied to about wars since this country began. Mm-hmm. The Indians didn't have to be our enemy, right? It didn't have to go down the way it did.
Right.
And so the same thing about the wars that are currently going, the seven wars or the next war, or whatever it is. I think the hope is that younger people will be able to question for themselves, is this really necessary? Are they necessarily a threat to us? They don't buy into the we have to fight terrorism forever argument as much, because the people that mainly support that, who make political hay out of it or make money off it or whatever, they've often been shown to be corrupt and warlike or unstable. like our current administration. And so I think we've got as much as we can to speak clearly. There's a phrase that we all use sometimes when we're trying to talk about these things to people. We say, well, you have to speak truth to power. You know, you have to have the courage to stand up and talk about racism, talk about what's going on. I want to add something to that. I want to say we have to speak truth about power.
Yeah.
Not just to it, but about it. What is it? Where did this come from? Why do these things, like a friend of mine helped put together a very good play about the Civil War, played at the Kennedy Center here in Washington, rave reviews. They had two parts, one about slavery and one about the Civil Rights Movement, which was good. But they missed a first part, which was, why was slavery created in the first place? Yeah. Was it just accidental or wanting to do bad things? You know, it was because that's how the economy of the country could be established. They needed slavery to build the economy and expand the nation. So if we could talk truth about power, then we start talking about the why of these wars, and not just detailed, boring history, but the actual stuff that pushes and creates them. And when you do that, the dots start getting connected in people's minds, and they start saying, well, maybe it's not necessary that we create more enemies constantly, and maybe we're all going to lose. The last thing I want to say is, in the last few years, I've been trying to talk about how we should, again, I'm into prevention rather than reaction. We should have been organizing years ago to prevent catastrophic climate changes. You know, it's nice to worry about how can we adapt and how can we adjust and so forth, but it would have been better if the nations of the world had started earlier and talked about how could we prevent it from occurring in the first place. So, again, these things are all connected. You know, the biggest polluter in the world, as I am told, is the military-industrial complex of the United States. You know, it will affect us all. It's already starting to. And so they're not just abstractions, wars in foreign countries, you know, past history and so forth. It's current. It's today. It's tomorrow. And that's what I'm concerned about.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. According to the Department of Justice, the channel you're watching now is an agent of a foreign, even hostile power. All the while, the DOJ refuses to explain why this is the case or even cite what laws we may have broken. But something else is in play. Critics warn RT is a test case for a wider campaign of media suppression. Cross-talking foreign agents, I'm joined by my guest, Lee Stranahan in Washington. He's an investigative journalist and co-host of Fault Lines on Radio Sputnik. In Salt Lake City, we have Rocky Anderson. He is a civil rights lawyer, former mayor of Salt Lake City, and the 2012 nominee of the Justice Party for president. And in London, we cross to Marcus Papadopoulos. He's the editor of Politics First magazine. All right, gentlemen, cross-talk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. I always go to the person that got up earliest for this program. That means it's you, Rocky, in Salt Lake City. You know, it's a long way away from Moscow. You know, and looking in my introduction, you know, the Department of Justice has forced RT to be signed as a foreign agent under the FARA Act, but they have cited no reason why. There is no complaint about our output of what we broadcast on this station here. No details whatsoever. No comparisons what we do or don't do compared to, let's say, Al Jazeera or BBC or CGTN. Nothing. We're separated completely in a different category. I can't come to any other conclusion that it is very spiteful, cruel, petty politics. Go ahead, Rocky, in St. Luke, in Salt Lake City.
Well, I think there's no question about that. We're seeing an almost a new McCarthyism in this country, and it's completely mindless. If people would realize that the First Amendment is really there to protect the people of this country and to promote an exchange of ideas and information and allow people the credit for being able to ferret out what they want to hear and what they can believe or not believe. This impacts all of us in this country when our own government is trying to restrict and even censor what we hear from other media. And we need to hear from other nations. It's a perspective that Americans have got to know. And it's certainly, it wasn't foreign media that was telling us all the lies that Judith Miller at the New York Times was telling us.
Very good example.
Leading up to Iraq, or the Washington Post about Jessica Lynch to bolster support for that outrageous war. These were all myths that were perpetrated by the U.S. media, and we haven't seen anything like that from media from other nations.
What we do see is
a different perspective.
Different perspective. Let me go to Lee in Washington. That's exactly correct here, because you've seen mainstream media. People have stopped watching it. They've stopped buying it, stopped clicking on it, and they're going elsewhere because they have lost the confidence in the mainstream media, the political establishment. And Lee, the people watching this program right now, no one's forcing them to watch it. It's a choice. I don't understand why the U.S. government should determine what propaganda is, and the U.S. government should determine what choices people make. Go ahead, Lee.
Well, I think it's because they are scared to death. They're absolutely, and by they, I mean the political establishment, not just the Democrats, not just the Republicans, the political establishment on both sides are scared to death that people are listening to alternative media. And let's throw in the media establishment as well. You got to remember, in the United States, I think it's six corporations that control 90% of the media. This is big business, right? And when people start listening to new media, when people can go to the news, not just to RT and not just to upstarts like the Huffington Post or Breitbart, both of which I've written for, but more importantly, to Twitter, to YouTube. And by the way, that's why we're seeing the other very scary trend now, which is that the tech companies are working to actually censor that media as well. So people realize that the establishment media is essentially a loss leader. In other words, when a guy like Jeff Bezos, head of Amazon.com,
and owner of the Washington Post,
$600 million,
and the owner of the Washington Post, go ahead.
That's right. And a $600 million, well, let's do the math, right? $600 million deal with the CIA. Buys the Washington Post for $200 million.
It's not even...
Pretty good deal.
Pretty good deal.
Pretty good deal.
Amazing. But the Washington Post will never talk about that. Okay, that talk about transparency. Marcus, let me go to you because, RT is being put in the spotlight, and I would say a target here. You yourself personally are a target in the UK media, and they're quite vicious in their attacks against you. Tell us more.
Yes, for me, Peter, this matter has become very personal. Recently, I was attacked by two members of the British Parliament, and the article and the report was run by the Times newspaper, in which I was depicted as a Russian propagandist. And because I'm a Russian propagandist, I should lose my parliamentary pass. Now, it is very, very callous, this attack. But then, Peter, we are living in very sinister times in which freedom of speech and freedom of the press in Britain and America is under attack. It's under attack by the British and the American governments, who are employing one of their most formidable weapons, their media, to go after anyone in the public eye who has a high profile and who happens to disagree with what the American and the British governments are doing on the international stage. Let me say this very clearly, Peter. The British and the American establishments hate us. They hate us because of our tenacity. They hate us because of how persuasive we are. And ultimately, they hate us because we are exposing the reckless, criminal and murderous foreign policies of Washington and London. Media in Britain and America is insecure. It is afraid and it's doing everything to try and destroy our names. They want to silence us. They want to put us back in our boxes. But the other point is this, Peter, is that we mustn't be under an illusion about who we're up against. We're up against some of the most powerful forces in the world. This is a contest. This is a David versus Goliath contest. But we all know what happened when David met Goliath.
And we all know, Marcus, that we all know on this program that we're on the right side of history, and they know they're on the wrong side. Lee, you wanted to jump in there in Washington. Go ahead, Lee. Go ahead.
Yeah, Peter. Yeah, let me mention something. Let me mention what Rye, and by the way, I agree with Rye. I'm a Republican, and I agree. And by the way, I'm the only Trump supporter on Sputnik. So much for the Russian media being pro-Trump, right?
Yeah, right.
I'm it. Now, I'm going to mention something that Rocky was talking about. I want to use a more contemporary example that's going on right now. Iraq's still going on, obviously, but Syria, right? Back in 2013, when I was a writer for Breitbart, I looked into what was happening in Syria, and I was worried. It seemed like U.S. taxpayer dollars were going to fund the quote-unquote rebels, who I saw were killing Christians, among other people. And I said to myself, look, most Americans wouldn't agree with that. So I had to quit Breitbart to go over. I did a crowdfunded trip to Lebanon to interview Syrian refugees. Okay. And it was obvious to me at that time what the U.S. was doing. And it was obvious to me that the so-called Syrian rebels were actually dangerous. And I came back. I was talking about the caliphate and ISIS. Nobody was talking about that.
Right.
Clearly, the weapons for them came from the U.S. Now, when I said that as a conservative who was reporting that, why when I say exactly the same thing on RT or on Sputnik, what's the problem there? And the answer is, let's explain what's going on with this Farah thing. It's very clear what they're trying to do here. They want to be able to say in articles, Stranahan, who, and by the way, they have not sent the note to Sputnik yet.
We're not waiting. Yet.
But they want to be able to say, whoever, Larry King, Jesse Ventura, Peter, whoever, right? They want to be able to say, who is required to file as a foreign agent, comma, said, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, okay.
And they want to be able to use that little phrase.
Exactly.
You see what I'm saying?
Let me go to Rocky. That's exactly it. It's the name and shame approach here. They can't fight our arguments. They can't fight our arguments because they know they don't have anything in their arsenal. And I would say that they've gotten so used to lying to the public and getting away with it. And then we hold fire to their feet. And that's what they don't like. And that's why they target each and every one of us to destroy our names, okay? Because they can't destroy the truth. Go ahead, Rocky.
That's exactly right. They are creating the conditions to making simply the ad hominem arguments so that they can paste these labels to people and instead of addressing the merits. And Peter, if we're ever going to see any of the conditions necessary for peace between people, greater understanding, we've got to have more accessible media. We've got to have, because that's the only way that we can learn about those things and about people and events that we don't personally observe. We've got to get it through the media and to strangle important sources of information and different viewpoints. And it's going to get ratcheted up. Now the Russian government is saying, okay, you're going to do that to RT. We're going to do it to Radio Free Europe and Current Times, the television equivalent.
Do you know what?
And
you know, Rocky, what's going to happen here?
We've been doing this for years.
Of course. And let me go to Marcus. But of course, when the Russian side retaliates, it's going to be called Russian aggression. What do you bet, Marcus, in London?
Well, that's going to be one of the negative, another one of the negative consequences of listing RT as a foreign agent, because the Russian government will have no choice but to take retaliatory measures. Russia, at the end of the day, is has self-dignity, has self-respect, and it has to stand up for itself. But, Peter, there's another dimension to these horrendous, awful attacks on RT and guests on RT. their reputations could be absolutely destroyed.
Yep.
And people who work for RT in Britain and America could find that their names are so badly affected that they're deprived of a livelihood.
We have a have to go to a hard break, gentlemen. After that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on foreign agents. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Okay, gentlemen, the Department of Justice doesn't give any justification for its actions in forcing RT to sign on as a foreign agent. But I will read something here real quick here from the Director of National Intelligence, that report that came out in January 6th, okay, titled Assessing Russian Activities and Intentions in Recent U.S. Elections. This is what I had to say about RT. RT's reports often characterize the U.S. as a surveillance state and allege widespread infringement of civil liberties, police brutality and drone use. Okay, continuing here. RT also focuses on criticism of the U.S. economic system, U.S. currency policy, alleged, they even used the word alleged, Wall Street greed, and the U.S. national debt. And some of RT's hosts have compared the U.S. to Imperial Rome, I guess that's me, and have predicted that government corruption and corporate greed will lead the U.S. to financial collapse. Rocky, what do you disagree with that? Because I think it's pretty good, good assessment. Well, it doesn't even mention what Marcus and I talk a lot about, foreign policy. But, you know, it's a pretty good checklist. Somebody watch some of the broadcasts. Go ahead, Rocky.
That sounds a lot like what I've been saying and writing for years, actually. So I don't know what it is anybody could find fault with there. But I will say, let them point to anything that could compare with the propaganda generated by the United States government and passed to the American people by our mainstream media. The Washington Post's abysmal story, the propaganda it passed on about Jessica Lynch, the soldier in Iraq.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Shot and stabbed and attacked by Iraqi soldiers. All of it, absolutely false. And, of course, Judith Miller and Weapons of Mass Destruction. But Naira, very few people know the story of Naira, the world's largest public relations firm, paid millions of dollars
Kuwait. Condense it down. It was the incubator scandal, okay? Okay, she was the daughter of the ambassador. Yeah, a scam
exactly.
Here.
Exactly.
Just a scam.
And this young girl was the daughter of the Kuwait ambassador of the United Nations, and all of the news media fell for it. Amnesty International fell for it. The President Bush was going around the country touting this just incredible story.
Rocky,
where is the accountability for the U.S. media?
Really,
there's nothing comparable.
It's very interesting here to all of you. I don't see human rights groups coming to the aid of RT. They won't, because it's political, and they know it, and they're intimidated here. You know, Lee, let me go to you, because you over there at Sputnik. All media outlets make mistakes. We all make mistakes, and we own up to them when we make them, okay? But what they're attacking us for is our narratives. That is something different. And this is, they cannot tolerate a different narrative that supports their fundamental material interests, intellectual interests, as if they're not very intelligent anymore. But anyway, they're friends, okay, and they're friends around the world. But they can't attack our narratives, because that would and legitimize us by having a conversation. So you dismiss all of it. Go ahead, Lee.
Well, let me say, you know, filmmaker Michael Moore, for instance, is a guy who, I'm a Republican, I don't agree with Michael Moore on a lot of issues, but you talked about alleged Wall Street greed, he's talked about that, right? But I've actually worked with another filmmaker who made a whole movie going after alleged Wall Street greed.
Yeah.
And you may have heard him, he's a young filmmaker named Stephen K. Bannon. Now, Steve and I worked together on a film called Occupy Unmasked, but Steve Bannon made a film called Generation Zero, and people can look it up. Steve's a former Wall Street guy who's very critical, a former Goldman Sachs guy, but in the 80s, who's very critical of Wall Street. And Steve has come out expressly. Now, what I'm saying is, when you get Michael Moore and Steve Bannon agreeing, right, on an issue, I think it's something that actually you'd get about 80% of Americans to agree. And this is exactly why the way that, look, what they want to do is they want to discredit RT, Sputnik, anybody who's not officially going along with that narrative, so that it says to Americans, hey, don't even listen. And by the way, we don't just see this with hosts. We were talking about this on Fault Lines this morning, my radio show. We have people who've told us we love the show. We love to listen to it. We do a morning radio show. So it's fun. We talk about politics. We crack jokes. My co-host, Garland Nixon, he's a progressive Democrat. I'm a Republican. But we agree on a lot of stuff, actually. We've had people tell us, Peter, they would love to call into the show just to, you know, be part of the show, and they're afraid to. They're afraid to call because we're broadcast in Washington, and they work for the government. Yep. I just want you to think about that. That's a chilling effect where people, not as a guest even, just to call in and say, hey, I don't agree with you.
It's very frightening. It's very much like when Chris Cuomo on CNN said, don't read those emails. Oh, we can read it for you. We'll tell you what it means. I mean, what a kook, okay? No wonder journalism is you know, basically no better than prostitution right now in the United States, in the West
Peter,
in general.
Can I jump in?
Marcus, jump in. I know you always want to jump in. Go ahead, my friend.
2 points I want to make. When you read that statement out, Peter, by the Department of Justice, two words entered my mind. How ironical. Because what they described is exactly how American mainstream media, conservative and liberal alike, portray Russia. Now, the second point I want to make is this, and I tried to make it just before we went for a break. The horrendous attacks on British and American citizens who work for RT, not only could end their reputation and deprive them of a livelihood, but something even worse. Given the horrendous levels of anti-Russian hysteria in Britain and America, there is a lot of hatred, even amongst ordinary Americans and British people, towards Russia. So imagine an American nationalist or an English nationalist or someone in America or Britain who is mentally unsound watching a report about how American and British citizens are traitors by working for RT, they're propagandists. It is possible, and I emphasize the word possible, that these people could take it into their own hands to physically harm guests who go onto RT in Britain and America, or British citizens and American citizens who work for RT. Now, that is something that these repugnant politicians and mainstream media journalists in London and Washington are not thinking about. And I would also add this as well. Look at the attacks. People who appear on RT are being referred to as uneducated, as imbeciles, and also one commentator in Britain has referred to them as mentally unwell.
No, but Marcus, one of the interesting things is, hang on here, Lee. One of the interesting things, because you're absolutely right,
is
that most of the people that are criticizing RT and criticizing people that come on RT don't know anything about Russia whatsoever. Okay, that is the real poverty of this situation. You know, people that actually come here and meet people, spend a little bit of time here, they see something very, very different than the black and white gray imagery that I was giving. We're rapidly running out of time, gentlemen. Let me go to Rocky here, because I think there's a really important point we all have to talk about here, is that the major tech companies are getting on their knees to please Congress and these people in this witch hunt here. They are signing their own death warrant, is what they're doing. They are foolish. They'll watch someone. They'll sacrifice us. But when they come for them, who's going to be there? They're making a very big Google, Twitter, YouTube, all of that. Go ahead, Rocky. We're running out of time here. Go quickly.
Yeah, that's such an important point, because this is all part and parcel of this creeping authoritarianism in this country. We're seeing a president who is so demeaning of our own media if it doesn't go along with his point of view. And now to say that we're going to choke off different information and points of view from media outside of this country, this is a horrible betrayal of the American people and our right to decide what it is we're going to watch and listen to and read and the points of view that we want to consider and make up our own minds about these things. I've never seen the kind of foreign influence on media that we saw leading up to the Iraq War, or the support for the first Gulf War through the Nayira manipulations.
Oh, but no. It should always be one direction. Only the West can influence everyone else, not the other way around here. You know, Lee, it seems to me, listening to what Rocky just said right there, is that liberals in America are creating the Soviet Union of America when you have this hermetically closed media box where no one can penetrate it. They only can hear messages. They can't hear anybody from the outside. That is very authoritarian and very dangerous, considering the level of trust that people have in the mainstream media in the United States and in the UK. Go ahead, Lee.
Well, that's why I think what we're doing on my radio show is so radical. It's not about me. Look, we got a Trump supporter and a Bernie supporter on the same show. You'd think if the commercial media wanted to appeal to a big audience, they would have looked at the election and gone, look at the size of Bernie's crowds, look at the size of Trump's crowds. It's a no-brainer, right? Why are we the only show that does that? Because neither one of us fit into the establishment narrative. And I got to say, let me just disagree with Rocky slightly. He's talking about to Iraq. Slightly disagree with him. Where the danger comes in, look, the CIA, I've been reading the history of the CIA in light of the new JFK stuff to come out. The CIA's first operation, 1948, was interfering in the Italian election.
Right.
It was literally the first thing that
they
did. They spent $100 million.
Yep.
That's history. That's not propaganda. It's on the CIA website. That's what they admit that they did. So this history goes back, actually, to the foundation and formation of the CIA. So, and I just want to take off on one thing that Marcus said, too. People getting called things. I've been called multiple times on Twitter a traitor. And I've had people say stuff like, traitors get shot.
Yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And nothing happens to the people. Nothing happens
to
them.
No.
Because it's acceptable.
It's acceptable when some people can use hate speech. It's acceptable when they use it, but not others. That's another double standard.
Right.
Gentlemen, we've rapidly run out of time. Fascinating discussion. Many thanks to my guests in Washington, Salt Lake City, and in London. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.